Hello and welcome to Ashes of the Imperium. My name is Dan, and as ever, I'm joined by the wonderful Max. Max, how are you?
I'm good, Dan. How are you, mate?
I'm living the dream, as ever. Today, we are talking all about the brand new Crusade narrative book, Pariah Nexus. So a return to the Pariah Nexus, and we're going to be seeing what those sneaky Necrons have been up to.
I think a good advancement of the story, I reckon.
Yeah. So longer time listeners of the show will remember back in a previous edition, or edition or two, was it ninth or eighth? I can't even remember.
Ninth edition, I think.
It was definitely ninth, yeah. It's all a blur. and a previous kind of Pariah Nexus campaign book came out. I think it was something Veil, Shadow of the Veil.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about the Necrons kind of unleashing their kind of weird weapon. Like, how would you describe it, Max?
A grand scheme. It's kind of a weapon without being violent, isn't it? Well, I mean, I can't remember from the old book, but do they reveal the entire machinations and purpose of what the Necrons are up to? Because it's certainly revealed in this book, which is pretty cool.
Kind of what we're led to believe from the first book, and that was the Crusade mission pack Beyond the Veil. I've just looked it up to get the name correct. Veily Necron Veily.
Veiliness, yeah.
Yeah, so Beyond the Veil told us, kind of introduced the Pariah Nexus, or to call it by its other name, the Nephilim Anomaly.
Which name do you prefer?
a Pariah Nexus for ease of pronunciation, I won't lie. I mean, Nephilim Anomaly is cooler, I won't lie.
And then an enemy.
It's just a lot of a lot of consonants, isn't it?
It bloody is, yeah.
Pariah Nexus has been introduced to it before, and the whole vibe there was this kind of Necron secret weapon that I guess kind of like sent everyone into this soporific stupor.
The stilling,
absolutely. Max in there with the correct names. I'm like, everyone's heckin' sleepy. And you're like, no, Dan, it's called the stilling. But yeah, so the stilling happened and basically like kind of like shut people down a little bit. Not, didn't kill them, but just kind of like turned them into kind of like zombies.
Yeah, like a bit comatose.
Yeah, comatose. And not zombies in a kind of our brains kind of way.
Nah, not Nurgly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The plagues of 8th edition, when Mortarion was unleashing his plagues. But yeah, so this kind of like shut people down into a kind of a stupor. And when Steve and I were talking about it, we were talking about how, you know, the warp is a manifestation of kind of human emotion and psychic energy. And so if humans are kind of shut down and not having all these emotions, then the warp kind of
loses,
doesn't exist,
its,
right?
Loses, yeah, its power. It loses its batteries, you know?
You have no power here, that kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
I suppose it reminds me slightly of, what was that brilliant film with Christian Bale and Sean Bean with the kind of ninja guns? You know exactly what.
Equilibrium?
I was going to say not Equalizer, Equilibrium.
Equilibrium, where they're the sort of gun-toting priest agents.
Yes, absolutely. I love it. What a cracking film. And it's got an excellent Bernese Mountain Dog in it. But that's by the by. Yeah, so in that, it's kind of like a 1984-esque thing where everyone takes a pill to remove emotions, right? Very, very kind of Black Mirror-esque. Mm-hmm. But I think the Necrons have kind of got a similar idea. So you know, the Necrons have watched Equilibrium. And they're like...
They're big fans of Sean Bean, yeah.
They're big fans of Sean Bean. I mean, who isn't? He dies in that film, which is, you know, very unlike him.
It never happens.
Oh, dear. Terrible. Terrible. So they're trying to shut down the warp, right? And they're trying to do that by shutting down a human's emotions. But it doesn't just happen to humans.
It talks about not just Eldar. Also, Leagues of Votan get a little mention.
Yeah, there's a scene where sort of Vastrum Illimitarum are like, oh, the floor's a bit squidgy. And they look down, they're just like walking all over the sort of...
Oh, that is gross, like, yeah.
Squirrels and rats or whatever.
Yeah.
Or like space squirrels and space rats. so it affects anything... With a conscience,
yeah,
a consciousness, not a conscience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure lots of Drakari don't have consciences.
No, absolutely not.
So Max, tell us more about kind of the stilling and the grand schemes.
Yeah, do you want me to kind of run through the main beats of a story? I guess I could.
Yeah, let's do it.
Take us through the whole thing. So,
yeah, Max, just read us the book. Take us through from start to finish, word by word, please.
So the whole story, all the dramatis personae. I reckon it's a story of kind of four parts, really. So what's interesting is, you know, Great Rift rips open the galaxy. Once that is kind of settled down, you know, they call it the Noctis Eterna, don't they? This kind of period.
Eternal
of,
night.
Yes, absolutely. This period of zero communication. You know, that lifts, so messages can finally reach Terra again. And it is, like, going crazy. It's absolutely bombarded with all these communications, pleas for help, the psychic screams of dying psychers. Like, it's, you know, every
bombarded
line is...
Bombarded with psychic distress calls.
That's it. Every line is busy, right? The psychic switchboard's going nuts. But...
Is it going nuts everywhere, Max?
No, this is it. So there is an area of silence which stands out. I think that's a really cool idea that the, you know, the whole galaxy is going crazy. Pleas for help from every, but there's just this black spot on the galactic map. I can imagine, you know, the High Lords of Terra like pushing their flags around their big table, and there's just this big like hole in the middle around the Pariah Nexus. So Gilliman thinks, okay, something's not right there. And dispatches this battle group Kalides, it's called, led by a guy called Groupmaster Marin, who I get the impression from the book is, you know, very stoic, competent kind of guy. They hightail it over there, big kind of combined fleet of Astra Militarum, Adeptus Sororitas. There's some Adeptus Astartes in there as well. There's Black Templars, Imperial Fists get a mention. The Minotaurs are mentioned as well. There's quite a lot of different chapters going, right? So they really kind of chuck a lot at this thing. They get to the worlds kind of bordering this zone. And, you know, there's all these doomsayers kind of claiming this onrushing, terrible presence that's going to consume everybody. All the kind of Xenos and Chaos forces around this region of space aren't fighting the you know, the Imperials necessarily, but they're kind of grabbing resources to get out of there. So it's like the animals running away from the you know, tsunami before it comes kind of thing. You get that kind of vibe.
Rats fleeing a sinking ship.
Yeah, but anyway.
End is extremely hecking nigh.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's all this foreshadowing. 40K loves a bit of foreshadowing, but.
Draw upon that, you know, narrative trope of...
this book's got a lot of narrative tropes in it, but we love it. Right. Anyway, so the navigators, they cross the boundary of the Pariah Nexus, and they report this kind of simmering, shimmering psychic veil at the border of the system. And immediately, everybody who is a psyker is, you know, they don't feel well. Put it that way. They're all badly affected by crossing this boundary. Because as we understand it, they're cut off from the warp, right? So their psychic source of power is gone. All the soldiers start deserting. Everyone's, you know, getting very unhappy. Warp engine starts stuttering. And the whole fleet gets dispersed, spread out. What was a big coordinated push is now lots of little kind of splinter fleets kind of dotted around the system, and they're all starting to like translate at different times, and it's kind of very stop start, right? The planets they come across initially are ghost-like. Anyone they do encounter is like an unresponsive doll, and there's this lethargy, the stilling that's affected them. And the only people who seem unaffected or less affected by the stilling are the Sisters of Battle, who are in the fleet as well. So it would appear that your faith in the Emperor is the best defense against this kind of physical, emotional malaise that is affecting everybody.
Good word, malaise.
Yeah, I'm trying hard.
yeah. And this is something that we discussed when we were going through the Beyond the Veil campaign book from the previous edition, was that, yeah, absolutely. It's almost like if you replace emotion with kind of blind faith, then you are less affected.
Mm.
So things like Space Marine Chaplains or Sisters of Battle.
Humans' interaction with the warp, it's you know, rage, isn't it? And lust and desire and gluttony and hate and all of those kinds of things is what like fuels chaos.
Yeah.
So the idea of being a zealot and so committed to one canonical thought, it almost doesn't give your soul room for any of those other emotions, does it?
You know, the word that comes to mind for me is purity.
Yeah.
It's like the purity of faith protects mm-hmm. them from the taint of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for some reason, protects them from distilling, because distilling is attacking the thing that is making up the warp. And therefore, mm-hmm. if you are disconnected from the sins of man, as it were, through the purity of your faith, then you're less affected.
I don't think the purity is a good thing, though, right?
No,
like these people aren't affected by it, but I don't think we're led to believe that this is aspirational.
No, and I don't mean purity in like a kind of pure and good.
No,
way.
Absolutely
it's
not.
Just
no.
Like the kind of the blind faith, the single-mindedness, perhaps is a better way of
putting it. Yeah. So it's playing with some interesting concepts, isn't it? This story.
Hmm.
I think it's I quite like the idea of the stilling. And what, how it kind of interacts with the factions in the story and the fact that there's a very technological element to the story, and when the Admech show up en masse later, that really goes into overdrive.
Sure, like talk about an arms race, right?
It gets really cool, yeah. We'll get onto that. But there is this very interesting, religious, matters of the soul kind of element to it as well, which I think is really good.
Yeah, it's like an interesting interaction of different concepts.
Yeah.
Of the kind of the matters of the soul versus matters of, it's kind of like matters, it's kind of religion versus science almost.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. They discover that the Battle Sisters are least affected, put it together, and what they start doing is embedding Sisters of Battle units, kind of spreading them out across the task forces and the fleets, to kind of create these hotspots of further for the Emperor. And I'll tell you what was really cool as well, it affects people differently, the stilling. So there's a description right at the start of the book of this Imperial Fist legionary, holding the line, and he's describing how the Astra Militarum are losing their heads to the stilling and puny humans. And then he's describing how his brothers in the Black Templars have lost their heads to the stilling, and they've just charged into the enemy, and they have run off and forgotten all reason, and the stilling has just turned them into mindless berserkers, and we've lost them too. And then right at the end of this kind of narrative beat, it sort of suggests that this Imperial Fist soldier is just standing there, unmoving, constantly like everybody is gone and left, and he's just still stood there with his bolter, just like blam 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 reload, blam 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 reload. So he's just kind of lost himself to his stoicism and I must hold the line. And I thought that was awesome how it's kind of just hinted at that even the Astartes are kind of affected by this as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because the last time we went through a review, and depending on whether I get the editing right, this one might come out before, but we did an Admech review, but just life's got in the way and that hasn't been edited and published yet. But in the same position within the book, the double page spread of narrative as you open it just after the contents, there is a similar little twist. There is a mm-hmm. story with like a kind of very, very Warhammer 40,000-esque kind of like weird bit of weirdness, bit of narrative twist.
Yeah.
Of the Astra Militarum adjutant, the bit I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. I do. Yeah, very cool.
And exactly the same there. It's kind of like, oh, here's two pages of lore of a very kind of interesting story. And also right at the end, it's like, but also this. And mm-hmm. you're just like, okay, cool. That it's, and I think I would refer to it as a scene setter.
Yeah.
And I think again, this double page spread has set the scene very nicely.
Mm-hmm. The lore in the books is the format kind of hasn't changed in a few editions, really, has it? Like, you've got the, subheaded column sections, you know, kind of running through the stuff. And then every now and again, there's something that isn't related to the chronological order of the lore that it's running through. They just have these like little flavor bits, right? Like, and they have been in this edition, these kind of double page spreads. And I mean, I've read the lore in the books for, you know, since I got back in 8th edition. And I don't know, I would say that the double page spreads that I've been reading for 10th in the 10th edition books are more memorable than previous books that I've looked at in 9th and 8th. I don't know if they've got different writers or if they've just made a bit more of a conscious effort to mix them up a little bit and try and do something a bit more interesting with them. But it's not just like bolter porn. It's, you know, they're asking some, there's some good twists in there, aren't there?
I like that. You know, and I know we were slightly facetiously saying like, oh, look at the narrative tropes. But I think they are trying to write stories that are engaging. One of my least favorite narrative books of the previous edition was The Arcs of Omen Angron, because it was so, it was kind of almost like unrelatable. It was all about this immortal demon that was just flying his way through space, blasting into ships and getting blasted apart and then reforming and stuff like that. And it was kind of like, where's the human story?
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me personally, what makes 40K narrative so interesting, even when you're talking about, you know, transhuman space marines, it is the human elements of their story, you know, whether that's like the Horus Heresy. I mean, that's what engages us as humans, right? That's what engages us across narratives in general, whether you're reading Wheel of Time, Lord of the Rings, you know, Stormlight Archives, whatever it might be, or, you know, Sarah J. Maas Fairy Smut, whatever it is. It's like the human story, the emotions that the characters go through and the development of the characters is what's interesting. And for me, Angron, like, what's the character development there? He's a very angry demon that's immortal.
Yeah, it's why Eisenhorn and Gorn's Ghosts are so good, right? Because
absolutely.
They're very human stories. And you could, I mean, I wouldn't want to put myself in those positions, but you could put yourself in those positions and like, okay, cool. I could be a guy with a gun in that situation and like, oh no, I don't want to be there. And that really relates to the book in that way. But yeah, going back to the narrative they're laying out, as the battle group Kalides is moving through the system, they discover these black stone pylons, right? Impossibly enormous structures. They talk about some of the pylons being so tall that they scrape the troposphere, which is the first layer of the atmosphere. So, you know, higher than Everest, these things, like enormous, like out of the atmosphere.
All right, Max, not all of us got a geography PhD, mate. Troposphere. So
they're big. Yeah, they're big. And on one particular planet, this jungle planet called Mesmok, they make a concerted effort to take out one of these things. The Necrons fight them back, repulse them. But as soon as they started attacking one of these pylons, Necron forces from other worlds warped to defend this particular pylon that was under threat on Mesmok. So they're like, okay, yeah, these are clearly very, very important. So Ultramarines try and take one out, but ultimately it was a failure. But embedded within the fleet was Lord Inquisitor Draxus, and she and her kind of elite task force are responsible for kind of mapping out lots of these sites of the particular pylons.
And is this shaved head dragon pet guy?
Shaved head shuriken pistol, dragon pet Inquisitor,
or from the Ordo Xenos.
She is. She's a radical.
A radical. Yeah. Not just like go surfing in California.
Nah, not rad.
Yeah. I think they are, you know, radical Inquisitors, you know, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Ordo Xenos Inquisitors, very, very interesting. You know, so the combination of those two concepts, I think it's cool. Like, she's got a pet dragon. She's got a shuriken cannon, catapult rather. Shuriken cannon, that's a big gun. Yeah. Shuriken catapult. Like, I just think it's really cool about how. There's this little story in the book where people are like, well, she hasn't reported how to destroy the Noctilith pylons to the rest of the Imperium. And she arrived at a very, very specific and slightly suspicious time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is she working with the Necrons?
Well, it says, it kind of says in the book, doesn't it? Because Imatek shows up later. And it's it kind of hints that, oh, isn't it strange that Inquisitor Draxus's strikes are timed so perfectly with Imatex? Like, what's going on there? So yeah, her and Imatex are best mates.
Yeah, and Imatex is, there's some Necron infighting, isn't there, between
there
Imatex,
is, yeah, there is, yeah.
The Stormlord and Zerak the Silent King.
What do you think of the Draxus model?
I think it's cool. It's interesting. I think it's the armor that I'm not 100% certain about.
Yeah, it doesn't feel very Imperial. But, I mean, it feels quite Xenos, which makes sense for her, I guess. It's kind of got like a Eldar vibe to it, hasn't it?
Oh, for sure, for sure. Yeah. I think it's the armor that kind of throws me off. I think, yeah, the silhouette of the armor throws me off slightly. It's very rounded, isn't it? It's it's got kind of design elements from some of the kind of Stormcast models. It's like sort of medieval in style.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I get what you mean.
But I think the kind of curved bits of the armor are what slightly throw it for me. I think if she had that kind of, she's got like a kind of big alien skull, Shredding catapult, big power fist. I think if all those design elements were incorporated in a more traditional set of power armor, I think for me, I would prefer the model. But I think the fact that the armor is so weird and wonderful kind of just demonstrates how that she is meant to be a bit different from the rest.
Yeah. But Battle Group Calades is not having a good time anyway. In this kind of first part of the campaign, there's only really one major victory, which is where Ephemeral Stern, the Demonifugue, Ultra Zealot, leads an early victory. There's an ice world called Cherist, and Stern and a big kind of task force of this battle group managed to take out some of the Dolmen Gates, the kind of Necron warp portals, basically, on this planet. And that battle is what kind of cements the conclusion that faith is the best defense against these entropic effects of the Stilling. They talk about the soldiers of the battle group clinging to their creeds like shipwrecked mariners to spars of wood in a storm, which I think is quite a nice description.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah. So, you know, you can imagine these pockets of supreme faith in this battle, and everybody's just kind of like crowding round the sisters to not lose their heads to the Stilling. And that's kind of the only real victory for the first battle group to come. It's then that the book reveals that, you know, all of this is a scheme by the Silent King. The ultimate goal is to divorce reality from the warp, and then the Silent King can go around and harvest all of the kind of husks of humanity that are left, and he wants to try and find a cure or a permanent solution to the whole biotransference thing. So his hope is that in this grand experiment there will be a long-term cure for the curse that he afflicted on his civilization, right? Like, but he's got some major guilt happening, right?
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
Now listeners can correct me in the comments if I'm wrong, but I don't think this element of the story was talked about in the previous Beyond the Veil book. I don't think this is where they're pushing it.
Yeah.
This is the narrative developing.
Mm, yeah. And that's, I like, cool. It. I like this idea of, I tell you what this book does really nicely is it humanizes the Necrons a little bit as well. There's one of those, you know, those double page spreads we're talking about. There's a really funny one where there's this overlord like leading an assault against an Imperial position that is dug in on a ridge. And it's from the overlord's perspective. And it talks about, you know, he's got his Praetorians around him and they're marching towards these lines, and his cryptech wants to unleash all of the horrible weapons that they have. But he's like, no, we must fight honorably here. And, you know, just shoot them with our Gauss blasters and slash them with our halberds, please. And no, I don't, creepy little cryptech. You just back in your box, all right? and he's marching, you know, towards the lines, and it talks about how he raises his staff of light and he tries to adopt a suitably noble pose. And it's just, I just like the idea of this like egotistical Necron overlord. Like, is this my good side? do I look okay? And they're going towards, but then the Silent King sends out an order, like, oh no, something bad has happened, just unleash everything. And then he sort of turns to his cryptic and he's like, oh, okay.
Make it so.
Yeah, make it so. We've got the order, honor's out the window, just go for it. And I didn't realize that the Necrons had this whole kind of code of honor thing.
Interesting. Yeah. The Necron kind of whole vibe has changed over the various editions of Warhammer, and this kind of this human side of Necrons was something that kind of got brought back in. So originally, now I might be getting this slightly wrong, but I think originally they were kind of semi-humanish, and then they got written as like these kind of completely mindless robots,
T-1000s.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then it was either they were human, it got rewritten as mindless, and then came back to being human, or when they were originally written, they were mindless. I can't remember the start of it, but I definitely remember there was this period of kind of like, maybe like, again, probably getting it wrong, fourth, fifth, something like that kind of thing. They were written as mindless robots.
Mm-hmm.
And the development of Necron personalities over the ages of 40K lore is, I think, one of the best things for that faction. Because I said before, makes them like relatable on a human level.
Yeah. I think that's a good point.
It's actually one of my least favorite things. And I think, again, that episode of the Advent Codex review, which has either arrived before or after this one, is something that I think we talked about then, is that like, I really love Admech, and actually I really like Iron Hands. Like, just conceptually, it's cool models, lots of vehicles, blah, blah, blah. But I don't like how unemotional they are.
Yeah.
And that kind of puts me off both those, you know, both the Iron Hands Legion in 30K, which I was going to do an Iron Hands army, and I listened to some of their books, and they're just not written in a very
not interesting,
engaging way.
Yeah.
So to see the Necrons like written in this way is very cool. The little description you just did there does remind me slightly of the Age of Sigmar Flesh Eater Courts.
Oh yeah, that's such a fun
faction, kind of like the delusions. I don't think these guys are delusional like that.
No,
I think they are just kind of more hanging on to a sense of honor from yesteryear. They are the kind of the true miladies of the first millennium. They're kind of doffing their caps at etc. Right, cool. So tell me more. What's the next stage
back
of
the story? So Battlegroup Kalidis, under a lot of pressure, another battle group shows up to kind of relieve the pressure a little bit. Battle group Orpheus, which is kind of delayed. Was sent at the same time ish, but kind of gets there and they kind of takes the pressure off a bit, but not so much. And then there is an Imperial Fist librarian called Epistolary Thengrist, who has an idea, suggests a psychic conclave on Cherist, this ice world, where Stern had her victory earlier. And he thinks, you know, get a big group of us together. We can get the signal out for help. Just keep them off our backs until we complete this ritual, basically, is his idea. And then there is a kind of counterpunch campaign with a couple of Astartes forces. There's a Black Templar group led by someone called Marshal Arnhulf, and then there's an Imperial Fist battle group led by Lieutenant Stormvor, and they launch this counter-offensive while this conclave is happening. And the Necrons are kind of attacking this ritual while it's going on, and the Imperials are slowly kind of pushing the lines out a bit. But they're able to, the ritual's successful, and they get this call for help out. Gilliman gets it, and he sends another battle group Hephaestus, which is led by Belisarius Kul. And their goal is to go in there, create a beachhead, and enable further reinforcement by Gilliman himself. Once he's finished all his paperwork, done his spreadsheets, he'll be like, you know, I've just got to finish this, and then I'll be there myself. Okay, so he sends Kul to kind of sort stuff out for him. And these guys are better prepared than the previous groups. We've got large Admech forces made up from Mars and Metallica. Again, depending on when that other episode comes out, we talk about how much I like Forge World Metallica. So it's cool to see them get a mention here as well. And they've got all kinds of, they've brought all the toys with them, right? They've got all of this archaeotech to get through the Stilling and to deal with, you know, the effects of the scattering and to kind of get a handle on the situation once they get there. And what Kul does is he splits the fleets into Aegis fleets, who are tasked with going out there, capturing territory, reinforcing, and just being like a military wing. And then there are accretion fleets, who are the kind of science element of this expedition, because Kul announces something called the Noctilith Decree, which is basically, get all of the Noctilith you can. We're going to build these things called liminal abrasers. There's so much pseudoscience in this. I love it.
We will build the science MacGuffin.
Here's this. So the role of the liminal abrasers is to apply positive empiric charge to make the quantum folded architecture of energy in the liminal zone between real space and the warp. So how's that? That's cool. That's Kul's plan, right?
Yeah. I think that checks out. The maths checks out.
And he reckons what this will do is this liminal space and this area of silence that the Silent King is trying to create, neither will tolerate the presence of this energy, and there'll be a big negative reaction against the energies that the Necron devices are pushing out, and it will just hit like a big reset button, right? So Kul wants to build these space MacGuffins out of Noctilith, out of Blackstone, to reverse what the Silent King is trying to do, basically. That's his big plan.
And how well does that work out?
Well, not great.
As nobody could have possibly predicted, it didn't work out to plan.
All of these techno magi that come along with him, they've all got their own agendas. They've all got their own egos. They've got their toys that they want to try out.
Oh, they certainly do, don't they? That's actually one of my favourite bits of the book.
Oh, we'll get onto that. It's awesome. But there are some successes, right? So they some of these accretion fleets manage to get quite a long way with these liminal abrasers. The Aegis fleets push out. They certainly help reinforce a lot of like beleaguered forces. And all at the same time as this, there appears to be a bit of a civil war going on in the Necrons, and Kul kind of takes advantage of that as well. So Imatek the Stormlord shows up. He is apparently intent on destroying this nodal matrix, this network of pylons that the Silent King has put up, and is causing the Silent King a lot of problems. So between Battle Group, Hephaestus showing up, and Imatek showing up, the Silent King starts to get pushed back. The two previous battle fleets, are Calides and Orpheus, they're kind of done at this point now. They're just kind of hanging on. But Kul does actually manage to establish a pretty decent foothold in the system, but with mixed success on these liminal abrasers. So it's at this point that Draxus, the Inquisitor, meets with Kul, says, I know how to bring these pylons down. It doesn't explain how she's got this knowledge, but it's kind of suggested that she's been working with Imatek a little bit, right? But she leads a mission with Tempestus Scions and elements of the Death Watch. They take advantage of this conflict between the Silent King and Imatek. And on the world of Voigoi's Alphic, they're successful. They manage to get into this pylon, detonate it, and it cracks the planet to this molten core. And that destruction of the pylon sends out, you know, it's like a real escalation in the campaign. That's the point in the two-page spread I was talking about with the Overlord, where the Silent King issues this decree, like, okay, right, gloves
off. Is that right? Okay, yeah. Chivalry's dead. They've shown a lack of respect for the rules of war, so we're just going to meet them on fair ground.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a real escalation in the campaign. It has ripple effects throughout the whole Necron Matrix. The Silent King basically concludes that the humans have proved themselves unworthy of the codes of honorable combat. So it's really cool that like the Necrons were holding back before, but they really let rip now. You know, all of the horrible weapons come out. The tech priests of Mars abandon Kul's plans, really, and they let loose a whole host of crazy weapons. I mean, you said this is one of your favorite bits. Is there any like bit from this part of the story that stands out for you?
I just think it's very 40K. You mm-hmm. know, it's just this weird arms race of mm-hmm. Of escalatory doom weapons, like mm-hmm. these kind of super weapons, and these two kind of Admech tech priests. One of them released a weapon called the Ark of Oblivion, which
that one stood out. Yeah,
Yeah, which I think quite literally like vibrated the Necron sort of metal to death.
Into sludge.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. The Ark streaked to the heart of the Necron fleet before unleashing a devastating contramolecular shockwave. Three mighty tomb ships shuddered in the grip of the Ark's power, the living metal of their hulls and their luckless passengers vibrating itself to a spreading slurry as excitation fields rippled through them. Like, okay, fine, pseudoscience applied, but it just sounds hilarious.
There's another one, isn't there, where the Techno Magi kind of puts this little box down, pushes the button and like runs away from it, and there's just this like growing black sphere that just expands and expands and expands and expands, and it like ends up eating like one third of a whole planet.
Yeah, and like completely throwing the planet off its kind of like orbital trajectory.
The Necrons are at it as well. There's a really cool description. They talk about a Necron device that's unleashed that uncoiled gravitic ribbons like whips thousands of miles long. So you can just imagine these like invisible gravity whips that just like smash a planet in half and stuff. It's so like epic in scale. But the real kind of tipping point of this arms race is something in the Skaran sector. There's a tech priest called Myrmidominus Gelf. Say that three times. He has a weapon called Shiverix Constellation, which is this group of satellites from way before like the Dark Age of Technology. Like, these have been sat in the warehouse for a long, long time, right? And he releases them in this system. In the Skaris system, a planet called Santis Magna. And the description of this is so cool. They kind of zoom out of their ship and they form these esoteric patterns in space, you know, this constellation of satellites, and release devastating energy weapons. It talks about, you know, it forms this pattern and then it like cuts like 10 of the Necron ships in half in an instant. And all the humans start, you know, cheering like, yay, we got him. And then the satellite turns and like adopts a new pattern, and it reloads, and then it starts cutting some of the human ships in half as well, and they're like, are we still cheering? But then it, you know, it carries on, and it's just like, it's this kind of all these different patterns that the satellites are forming. I just had such a clear picture of this in my head, and eventually it forms this final node in the sequence, and it manifests a tear in the warp, and from this tear in space the demon
planet. I take it all back. This is my favorite bit.
Yeah, so this big tear in space opens up from this, you know, like the Dark Age of Technology, right? Like all the techno barbarians, like God knows what horrific energies of chaos this thing had. Like, how long has this plan been in?
Energy weapons that had been ancient when the God Emperor ascended his throne. Like, these things are banned for a reason, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And what comes out? Yeah, what comes out, Max?
This Terran space comes, and the planet of Wormwood comes out, the demon planet of Vashtor the Archophane itself. As the planet emerges and the fleets of renegades and demons and heretics emerges from this planet in their, you know, dark flotillas, that's where the curtain falls and the story, you know, to be continued. I just thought that was a really epic conclusion to what was a already kind of nicely escalating storyline.
It's a really nice narrative crescendo towards the end, where, you know, the Imperium and the Necrons are kind of going at this mad arms race, releasing these kind of more and more extreme weapons against each other. And then, yeah, very much a kind of like EastEnders end of episode dun 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 moment when you know, Vashtor the Archophane sort of turns up.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be really interesting to see, you know, where they go, you know, what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm excited to see the next chapter. I want to know how this story ends. So.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. I know they have some, there's some Black Library books set in the Pariah Nexus, isn't there? I don't know if they've taken this story any further yet.
Warhammer Plus.
Is it? It's a series, isn't there? Yeah.
There's a series literally called Pariah Nexus.
Yeah.
I've watched it. It's okay.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, it's written in a weird way. Like it's delivered in a weird way, rather not written. It's kind of very hearty. It's cool to watch. Like it's Warhammer on TV. Like that's fun. It's just a bit kind of I don't think it flows particularly well because it's so it kind of keeps
which is. Yeah, that's interesting because I think we both agree, right, that the story in this book is really good fun. I like the flow of it. I like the escalation of it, and it's probably my favorite part of the book, to be honest. Because I mean, what we've not spoken about is any of the crusade rules or the missions that are in this book as well. I just kind of got engrossed in the story, to be honest.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you've ever given Crusade a go.
Don't know about you, but I struggled to get games in full stop.
Yeah,
let alone consistent campaign games with the same people.
Mm-hmm. So I probably play if things are going well once a week. But I play at least every fortnight, right? And I find that when I've got my game night, I just want to like throw down 2K lists. But this is just the type of gaming I enjoy, right? Throw down 2K lists, like, you know, nice kind of competitive lists, and just have a kind of go at each other, and that's how me and my friends like to play. When we've tried Crusade, I just get a bit. Like, I don't know, like, I like role-playing games. I play Dungeons & Dragons, you know, like...
Absolute nerd.
Once a fortnight and stuff. Like, I'm not averse to driving a narrative and character admin and all of that kind of stuff. But I just find the Crusade system too much. And I don't feel like it drives story effectively enough either. Like, if I'm playing... And we'll talk about this in a minute, like... If I was to play some narrative missions inspired by this, I wouldn't use the Crusade system, put it that way. I'd come up with some thematic lists and just come up with a little fun scenario of myself, which I know is something, you know, you and Steve used to talk about a lot, wasn't it? Was how can we build fun narrative missions from the kind of lore snippets that we find in these books, rather than let's go through every single Crusade mission in order that's in this book. And yeah, I don't know, it's not a system that I've ever really engaged with much since it came out, and I just don't think I'm going to start anytime soon either, to be honest.
No, that's fair. I think it takes a commitment. One of my favorite games Workshop has ever created is Mordheim. But I love that so much because when I've played it, it's been when I was sort of young, like a, you know, young teenager, or even earlier, or it's been when I was in my very, very early 20s and playing Warhammer like once a week with my friends, all the guys at the club every Wednesday night at what the local shop, you know, it was a great, like a really positive time in my life. And, you know, we were young, enthusiastic, playing Warhammer all the time. I don't know, like, bring me back to those times. And we started a Mordheim campaign. So I've got really fond memories of Mordheim from childhood, but I've also got really fond memories of kind of revisiting it. You know, and back then it was an old game, but revisiting it as a young adult. And so Mordheim has got a whole bunch of bookkeeping and RPG elements, but it's very, very, I think, straightforward. There's a lot of admin to do, but it's very straightforward. It's
kind of skirmish scale as well, isn't it, Mordheim?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess do you think you can get more invested in your characters if...
Yeah.
Because like what I've struggled with Crusade is like, right, okay, well, let's give all the squads a name, you know, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, we're still just like Space Marine Bob. I just struggle to, like, you know, like I can think of cool stories for the captain and the sergeants, and you know, sometimes the game itself will create the story for, oh, like, you know, that Hellblaster Ricky like took out the knight on an epic last ditch shot.
Did you just call a Hellblaster Ricky?
Yeah.
Is he married to Bianca from EastEnders? So this is the second EastEnders reference this episode. American listeners are probably thinking, who on earth are Ricky and Bianca?
Well,
and all the English listeners are like, yeah, we understand. Of a certain generation, I should.
Yeah. But, you know.
Anyway, Ricky is...
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes, okay, cool, right, he's got a story. But, I don't know, I can't think of cool narrative stuff to get engaged with for the 24 other intercessors in my list, you know. It's just like, oh, okay. But I think with something like Mordheim or Necromunda or Kill Team, easier to create those characters, maybe.
Yeah, because you're dealing with individuals, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, that's my two pennies on Crusade. But I know a lot of people enjoy it, so you know, I'm sure they will. Because what I would say is the Crusade rules presented in the Leviathan book are very specific to the Tyrannic War, and the missions are very specific to the Tyrannic War. So it's good to get some other settings and some other factions and some other flavor for 10th edition Crusade, you know?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I think one of my favorite, you know, talking about that narrative element of it and finding stories and finding it difficult to kind of get behind the narrative of like squads rather than individuals. One of the things that I really, really like about this book, and it's something Steve and I used to, you know, really, really enjoy it. And I think we hold Vigilus, the original Vigilus campaign books, as like a real high point in modern 40K campaign books. And when the Beyond the Veil book came out, we actually discussed how it was a shame that this wasn't like that. Is that they had, you know, orders of battle in Vigilus, it had orders of battle, yeah. and kind of it had named regiments, whereas mm-hmm. the narrative in the Beyond the Veil book, because it was a mission pack, it wasn't a campaign book, it was mm-hmm. a mission pack. So. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no point in getting annoyed and be like, oh, this mission pack had nothing but missions in it and a handful of narrative pages. Well, that's what it was designed to have, so fine. But on page, I want to say like 16, 17 of this book, it's got a double page spread. It's got a map, a galactic map.
Yes.
Like maps in campaign books, like already you are, you know, plus 5 points out of 10. You know, if you've got a map, then yeah. I'm sold.
I'm looking at the notes I made for this chat, and highlighted in bold and you know, nice green letters is epic map on page.
Epic, yeah. Epic, yeah. Like, so if you've got a map, great, you're already in my good books. And yeah. then if you've got orders of battle, then you are also like, you know, get those two things. Just have a campaign book with maps and orders of battle, and I will buy that. I will buy that mm-hmm. and read it until mm-hmm. the cows come home. It kind of harks back to the original Imperial Armor books that
yeah,
brought out, yeah, you know, Vrax yeah. and things like yeah. that. Yeah, really cool. And so there's a little double page spread. It is just a 2-page spread with a map and some battle groups listed on it. But it lists some really cool sounding Astromilitarum mm-hmm. regiments. So you've got classics like the Mordian Iron Guard. Mm-hmm. Hey, wouldn't it be cool to see plastics of those? Maybe as a kill team, that would be mm-hmm. cool for sure. And you've got things like Cadian shock troops, but you've also got Cadian heavy reconnaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, like, what does that look like? How can you create an army of heavy reconnaissance? Is that like armored sentinels? Is that things like the salamander tanks? Like, that would be cool to, you know, see a new plastic salamander tank come out, maybe do a conversion, write a little bit of homebrew rules to kind of do a Cadian heavy reconnaissance army made up of only things like salamanders, hellhounds, sentinels, you know, that yeah. kind of thing, right? Maybe some snipers, all that good stuff. Yeah. But then you've got these weird and wonderful regiments. And I'll read you some of the ones that are all the ones that I've written down here.
Yum.
So the Gascayan armored gunhounds, the Kyogan mounted reconnaissance. So mounted might suggest,
mechanized, armed, you know, mechanized, like in chimeras sure. or something.
Yeah. Or it might or be literally. Like Rough Riders. Yeah.
yeah.
Like, what are they mounted on? Like, what, you know, Rough Riders ride horses because they're trying to sell models to humans, i.e. customers in the real world. And, you know, we understand what a horse is. Whereas on Kyogan, like, what the planet or the system of Kyogan or Kyoga, whatever the planet's called, you know, what do the locals ride?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it like spiders or is it mm-hmm. like camels? I don't know. Like, you know, there's just... Or big lizards. Could you take that? That's a great... There you go. Take some Seraphon models. Take some Age of Sigmar Seraphon or Warhammer Fantasy. Those old Dark Elf Cold ones, you know, that come with kind of humanish, like humanoid legs on it.
Mm.
Create some cool mounted dinosaur riding dudes. And those are your Kyogan mounted reconnaissance. Like, that's a cool concept. You know, instead of having tanks, have a massive Seraphon dinosaur. Whatever.
And that's just one regiment name.
That's just
in
one
the,
regiment.
In the kind of order of battle, you know, yeah.
Absolutely. You've got the Oswerdian Musketeers, the Mitorian Rogues, the Latauran Artillery,
I like the sound of those, the Mitorian rogues.
Yeah, the Mitorian rogues. Not to be confused with the Mitorian scoundrels.
I imagine lots of like moustache wax and
sailors. Oh, yeah. Yeah, cads. Cads and bounders, the mat to a man. You wouldn't introduce them to your sister.
Or the sisters.
Or indeed the sisters, who would be doing very well in this system because of their purity and piousness. Mm-hmm. So you've also got things, cool things like Caffey Stoutbacks, who are in Votan or Kin, i.e. Leagues of Votan, Kin mercenaries. You've got Abhumans, and then you've also got, interestingly, it said Abhumans, and then the next line said Minotaurs. I was like, wow, Abhuman Minotaurs? Like, the Imperium's really pushing this whole Beastman thing. But no, it's just like the Space Marine Minotaurs.
Yeah, old Moloch.
Yeah, again, a cool chapter who we've spoken about recently. But it's cool to see them, you know, make a little appearance. And yeah, I just like that just on those two pages, you know, I've just gone on a little passionate rant for 5 minutes about just those two pages. And for me, I think those two pages, the strength of the story, like, sure, yeah, a load of silly pseudoscience, but it is sci-fi, fine. Like, on those two things, like, the book is a win for me.
Yeah, I really like it. Imagine those two pages, but 10 times as much content in that vein. Like the Anfelion Project. It's just a cool storybook with all the maps and the after-battle reports. And, you know, that's what I would get really excited about and want to see more of. And, like, honestly, 50% of this book, I'm not that interested in, because I don't enjoy that part of 40K. But the story was brilliant. Like, I would like to see just more of that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is really interesting, the, like, inconsistency of the nature of their narrative supplements. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes you get mission packs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get things like the Vigilus, you know.
And
like,
Vigilus was that, wasn't it? Vigilus was loads phenomenal. And loads of story, and this battle happened, and that battle happened, and here's who was involved, and here's a map of the system, here's the cities, like, so much to build off there. And then it had, you know, the rules were cool, because you got, like, the detachments you could use and stuff, and it wasn't all, you know, constrained by this crusade system. It was you can use these detachment rules and play whatever kind of 40K game you want, like, and there was just so much content in there of the type that we're talking about, that we love so much, you know, this really descriptive, really flavorful. Loads of geography in there, you know, orders of battle and lists.
not biased, are you? Loads of geography.
No. But, you know, that's what I would like to see more of, for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, it's not like a not recommend. Pick it up for sure. It's an interesting book. It's a cool story. And it's got some cool, like, narrative hooks in it. And if you play Crusade, or if you're looking for some missions to kind of spice up some regular games, then it's even better value. I would buy this book just for the kind of narrative half, for sure. And if I happen to play, like, one or two of the missions out the back, maybe once or twice, then it would be an added bonus. But for me, I think, like, if they produce this kind of level of cool narrative stuff, but to the scale of, like, an Imperial Armor book, then, like, that is peak narrative 40K for me.
Yeah, my friend's got a big Necron army. I'm definitely going to suggest let's play a couple of these scenarios out. That could be really good fun.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. Talking of Necrons, as ever, we are doing a giveaway with this episode. So comment on the bottom of the YouTube channel. So we're giving away two models. We're giving away an Imitek the Stormlord and an Orokan the Diviner. So if you collect Necrons, or you just fancy yourself a Necron model to paint up as a little project, then we'll give away two of those. One will be given away to someone who comments on the YouTube video for this episode, and one will be given away via Instagram. There'll be a promotional post. Follow the page, like the post, and tag a friend in either the episode promotional post, or a week or so later, we'll do just a specific giveaway post. One of those two, either one, we'll just put them all in the pot. And we'll do two draws for Imitek and Orokan. Thank you for Games Workshop for sending to us. We weren't able to get them painted up in time for the pre-order. So we kind of wanted to share them with the community and to our listener base. And yeah, hope that someone can put them to good use. Apart from that, let us know what you think. Let us know what you think of this book. Let us know what you think of the episode. Whether you think, like, that Vigilus was the highlight of recent modern narrative 40K, or whether you've got a different opinion, do let us know. We'd always be keen on hearing what you think. All that remains is to wish you a very happy hobbying. Keep calm and crusade on.